Aloha. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. The fireworks explosion that killed six in the Aleomanu Salt Lake area took place a year ago. We check in on a neighborhood anxious to have a safe and quiet New Year's Eve. We pay a visit to the wall that heals, a traveling Vietnam War memorial. We'll stop in Kapolei in the coming weeks. We meet a sharp-looking bird with a bold red mask on this week's Manu Minute. Plus, we take stock of the year and set resolutions for 2026. We learn quick techniques to manage our stress as we look ahead to what comes next. And the curtain is about to come down on a standout hula show on the beach in Waikiki. We hear from the performers and crews that are part of the weekly performances. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's New Year's Eve, and who knows what the fireworks scene will be tonight. It marks a year since an explosion of illegal aerials killed six people and injured dozens of others. HPR's Cassie Ordonez spent time in the neighborhood recently where the deadly blast took place and joins us now. Good morning.
Morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so you went door to door, and I understand that some of the families have moved away.
Yeah, I did go door to door, and some families have moved away. I was lucky to reach out to one person who was comfortable being interviewed. But for the folks who didn't want to be interviewed but did give me some information, is that the Aleomanu neighborhood on Kiaka Drive has been generally quiet. One resident who I talked to, named Jack Kaowai Jr., said that he heard his first firework actually this past weekend on Saturday. And Kiaka Drive in the Aleomanu neighborhood, he said that he was so used to hearing fireworks pop off almost every day. And then after the tragic New Year's incident, you know, it's been mostly crickets. But, you know, it's in the back of everyone's mind. People are still kind of on edge for this upcoming New Year's Day and New Year's Eve today. But it's more of a wait and see. But Jack Kaowai Jr. said the neighborhood is still trying to move forward.
The first few months, I would say like actually the first half of the year, everybody was still kind of uptight about everything, but life has to go on. So everybody's adjusted and it's like everybody's back to normal now. But since it's getting near that 1 year mark, now it's at the back of everybody's mind, yeah. This is a really strong community, Filipino dominated over here. So they have their things like after the 1 year death anniversary, they usually have like prayers and stuff. But what I heard is a lot of people is not going to be, if they do New Year's Eve, it's not going to be here. Some probably go to like Vegas, or some will do staycations in Waikiki. Others will go to family parties in other neighborhoods. Yeah, but just to get away from Aleomanu.
Yeah, so it's a very close-knit neighborhood on Kiaka Drive and the Aleomanu neighborhood. And, you know, Jack described the neighborhood as mostly home to Hawaiian and Filipino blue-collar workers. And that New Year's Eve day, Jack was exchanging food with his neighbor on 4144 Kiaka Drive where the incident happened. And he was asked to stay, but he already had his own house party to go to. So he returned to his house party, and he lives just down the street facing Foster Village side. He was overlooking that landscape, and 20 minutes after, when this clock struck midnight, that's when the incident occurred. And that was just a drastic scene. But there's still sensitivity around there. And when I was door knocking, some folks didn't want to be interviewed because it is a sensitive issue. Others have moved away. There was one family who I did talk to who lives right across the street from that house where the scene happened. It's a new family. They were about maybe 4 or 5 months in, and they said that they can still see cracks in the ceiling and in the kitchen area when the explosion happened. So that's still a constant reminder of what happened that day. But New Year's Eve, it's a huge day for Hawaii. It's a huge celebration while the rest of the United States celebrates July 4th with fireworks. Hawaii saves its fireworks for New Year's Eve. And when you see all of Oahu, for example, you're either walking or driving through a war zone. And then when the clock strikes midnight, that's when you just see everything popping off during that time. I know in some Asian cultures, fireworks are used to ward off evil spirits. But over here, it's been a longstanding issue with local authorities and other officials.
Yeah, public safety's paramount, you know, given this tragedy. I mean, it was terrible.
Exactly. When I was talking to Jack Ka'ovai Jr. about it, he said that, you know, fireworks has always been a part of Hawaii's culture, but specifically firecrackers. The aerial fireworks, which are illegal and should be handled by professionals, that became really popular amongst the public in the 1990s. And he remembers when the law changed.
I still remember because they used to have Pain Save, and we still always buy our fireworks from here. And then right when it converted to longs, they had the law had changed. I guess because so much firecrackers, it made this big cloud of smoke and nobody could breathe. So they changed the laws on the firecrackers where you had to purchase a permit. It was like so much dollar amount for $5,000 you can for carry so much firecrackers, yeah. So you'd have to buy, like, if you wanted like a 40,000, you would have to buy, I think, like 8 permits. And each permit was like $20. So what happened was that's when the black market rose and they were selling the firecrackers on the black market to get it. So people would buy just like 1 permit, 2 permits, just to have it on hand in case they get it checked out, yeah. But then that's what created the aerials. In the beginning of the 90s, the aerials was big, but not to where it is. The stuff that they have in the neighborhoods now is like stuff that belonged in Hilton Hawaiian Village, like commercial stuff, yeah. It's crazy how fireworks has evolved to that, what it is, but then everybody loved fireworks growing up.
Yeah, it is crazy, but you know, law enforcement isn't gonna mess around this year. And we just saw the indictments, I think, that were handed down by the feds yesterday, the two Big Island people that were you know, alleged to be bringing in fireworks. So definitely going to be a crackdown.
That's right. But we're also seeing the aftermath of the burn victims, too. I know all the burn victims, they're out of the Arizona hospitals since May. The last one was in May. They're still receiving continued treatment. I talked to Straub yesterday, and they said that, you know, this is going to be a long recovery from them, both physically and emotionally, psychologically. They're still going to the Straub burn clinic to receive care. So the aftermath has actually been taken very seriously among law enforcement, and also the fact that lawmakers have updated laws and passed laws that enforces fines against owning and lighting illegal fireworks and having drones. I spoke to David Yoms. He's a retired police officer and chair of the Liamanu Salt Lake Foster Village Neighborhood Board. And he says while the laws may help, he said more should be done in tackling the fireworks issue.
I'm assuming the police will be out. They have drones now, and hopefully, I think it would be a success if the police can arrest. I would give them a number. If they can arrest 25 people island-wide for fireworks, that would be a success because they haven't come to that number in years. I mean, they've never come up to that number. I think more than 25 or 50 arrests. I would say that would be a excellent number to shoot for, between 25 and 50 arrests, not citation. These citations, they don't care. People don't care if they get a $300 citation. That's just like tinted windows. You get tinted windows, you pay $547. I think the fine is, or $597. I'm going to look that up. But, you know, you're paying more for tinted windows than actually, you know, violating the fireworks law. $300 is it's worth it to some people. That, so what? I get a ticket, I get a ticket. You know, they got to arrest them, make the arrest, charge them for the offense with high bail, and also put their names in a newspaper and what street they live on, so everybody knows that this guy or this girl cannot follow the law, and they will be taken to court and the prosecutors will seek a conviction.
Yeah, so we'll just have to see how it goes tonight. But thanks so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
All right, and stay safe out there.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Energy, providing local businesses customized energy plans. Learn more about lighting upgrades available through February at hawaiienergy.com/lighting.
HPR is committed to sharing beautiful and inspiring music from Hawaii and around the world. and news that both informs and elevates local storytelling and ideas. We are moving forward together at 100% independent and fully backed by the community we serve. Your first time or upgraded monthly gift keeps the service free and coming your way every day. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
It's called the Wall That Heals. It's a replica of the Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C. that honors Vietnam veterans. And in January of this year, the exhibit traveled to the Big Island in Maui. Sponsored by the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund, the exhibit will open next month here on Oahu for the first time. For about a week, it'll be on the Great Lawn at the University of Hawaii West Oahu campus. Hundreds of Hawaii veterans are among the more than 58,000 names on the walls of Americans who died serving their country in Vietnam. The first soldier from Hawaii to be killed in the war was James Gabriel Jr. Ed Freeman and his wife, Susan Bauer, have worked with James Gabriel's sister, Billy, to bring the wall to Hawaii. Freeman was a Marine and recalls the fall of Saigon 50 years ago.
They have different stories of how these 278 people passed. Being a Vietnam vet myself and being over there, of course, we don't know each other personally or whatever, but we are buddies, we're pals, because we served a common purpose. Whether your opinion of what was happening there was anti or you were forward and stuff, that doesn't matter. We were a group of people that shared a mission together, and we still want to be together, even today, 50 years later.
Yeah, there's that bond.
Yes, exactly.
As we consider the anniversary and the fall of Saigon, where were you that day?
In one of the helicopters during the evacuation. The squadron that I was with, the helicopter squadron, was out of Kaneohe. They no longer exist as helicopters. They've outdated themselves and whatever. But in my squadron, we flew for a day and a half, moving the number of Vietnamese and Americans from Saigon, from the embassy there. It was quite a day. It's something you train to do certain things, but it's never the same as the training when it's the real thing happening. There were no redos. It was now or never kind of situation. The horrible part about the whole thing was you became a person that chose, for lack of a better word, the people that got on the helicopter and left. So some of the people didn't fit the criteria. They had too much. They brought their whole life savings, their whole life of everything with them in the helicopter. And we were told to expect and examine everything they had because we didn't want any incidents happening once they left. That was how that went. And like I said, you became the person that said, oh, I'm going to take this guy and not this guy. And then a lot of them didn't care about themselves. They were actually passing their children along. They wanted a better life for them as opposed to the parents themselves. So it was a pretty awkward situation. I still get emotional myself, even after 50 years.
Understandably. Anyway. And that's why you folks are involved in this incredible project.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So talk about the fact that this wall, and it just arrived at the harbor today, but we here on Oahu will be able to see it for the first time because it came to the Big Island last year. Now, talk about that.
They were unable to get it here to Oahu. There was a lot of complications with that at that time. But yeah, when it comes here, I was one of those people that was mentioned, the people that disagreed with the war at the time. But we got together. We've been together over 40 years. We got together shortly after. We both ended up here in Hawaii in 1975 and got together shortly after that. So it was something we didn't really talk about very much, and Eddie never really talked about it. And I think being here in Hawaii was a bit different than on the mainland in that there wasn't the violent aggression toward the Vietnam veterans here. I never experienced it, and we were here after the evacuation.
I want to hold you up on that just a little bit. Your perspective of it was very innocent and whatever how it was happening, but to a person that was that particular person that they were talking about, it was a whole different scenario because you performed a mission that was supposed to be making it better for us here, But then those people that were not with us there became against us. And even I have a couple incidents right here on Kapi'olani Boulevard. And I became very upset about it and stuff. And it was almost making you ashamed that you were an American soldier or a veteran or anything there. So it took on a different perspective for a veteran, a Vietnam veteran to be exact, than what it did with a civilian person, whether you didn't actually see anything that was happening, but inside of the veteran himself, he felt it. He knew what was happening. And again, a reason why we're doing this is there are actually veterans out there that's still living this every day. And so that made it more difficult having been in Vietnam and then coming home to this almost the same wrath you were facing there, you faced it here. And it wasn't undercover or a secret mission that was going on. It was blatant right in your face that you had to deal with it.
Yeah, there's so many stories. Everybody's got a different take on it. I have a brother who served in Vietnam, and he was going to Berkeley at the time. And, you know, there was a lot of anti-war sentiment. And he quit college and signed up to go fight in the war. Like I said, every veteran has a different story and a different takeaway.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so this wall. So what's your hope?
We're hoping that we have a good turnout, number one, of people, but we're honoring those that we lost in the war, but we're also honoring those that are still alive, that served, and we're inviting them. And we have a whole separate ceremony dedicated just to our hometown heroes. Following that, we have another ceremony on the night of the 17th that they call Light the Night, and that's where they're honoring and recognizing all the veterans that passed after the war. But served.
Came home after.
Yeah, so we actually have the wall will be set up. It will change colors, and it will be lit in orange, basically bringing awareness to the Agent Orange exposure and that how there are a lot of people that passed after the war. There are a lot of people that are alive now and still impacted by the effects of Agent Orange and the other chemicals in the war. One of those people was here in the room that was affected. Eddie was there. So, yeah, we're just hoping that it brings the ideas to educate people on the wall as well, because the trailer that it comes in is filled with all the panels that make the wall. It's 140 panels, but it's 375 feet long when it's assembled. And so that trailer itself converts into an education center with a roof and showcases that go down the side that have a timeline of the war itself. It has visual digital displays of our hometown heroes, of those that are in memory, which are the ones that were lost after the war. We're offering school tours, private tours. We have ongoing group tours that are just open tours if you don't have a particular group to come with you. So it's mainly to honor all those folks that were never really recognized and honored upon their return, and to educate as much as we can, and giving people an opportunity to find their loved ones on the wall as well.
And so tell us the particulars. When can people actually go out, maybe take part in the ceremony, official ceremony, and how long will it be up?
The wall will be up for 7 days until January 19th. It will be closing at 2:00 that afternoon, but it's open 24 hours a day, starting the night of the 13th, basically, the Tuesday. Our opening ceremony is the morning of the 14th, January 14th, which is a Wednesday. And that'll be about an hour, and that'll just be basically a synopsis of the whole event, presenting a number of our dignitaries and military and civilian here will be present. Our mayor will be a speaker. And then the following night, in the evening at 5, we have another ceremony that's just called Welcome Home. And that's where we're actually honoring, with more attention paid to the veterans from Hawaii that passed, as well as those that are still alive and with us. And then the Friday, it's open all day, all night, just to the general public. We'll have tours going on. Tours are only during the daylight hours, but the wall is open. The education center is lit. The wall is lit overnight. And we have volunteer staff that will be there overnight as well.
Yeah, Wish is going to ask about that because this is a major undertaking. You need help from the community to put this together?
Absolutely. Yeah. We're looking for volunteers in every aspect of it. On our website is a link to the Sign Up Genius, and it actually lists every single slot for our volunteer opportunity. And there's so many different jobs that people can do. I mean, we have seated positions that are in the information tent. We have people that will be handling greeting and parking and things like that. We have basically the volunteers on the wall, and those are the people that are out there with people, helping them find, you know, their loved one on the wall. And we have the opportunity, they have the opportunity to do wall rubbings of the name, because the wall itself is a composite granite material, so they're able to exactly duplicate the wall in Washington, D.C., as the names are engraved, not just printed on there. So that was the best fun part, because that was where really, they say the magic happens on the wall, and it does. You meet the most interesting people.
That was Susan Bauer and Ed Friedman, and we'll have more of our conversation right after a short break. Let's get back to our conversation with Ed Friedman and his wife, Susan Bauer. Friedman picks up with a unique experience that several community members will share as the wall is assembled.
If you have a relative, a loved one, whomever, that's on the name is on the panel, you can actually come out there and sign up and escort your panel to the frame as they're assembling the wall itself. That's as personal as you can get with it to carry that panel. We do have several people that's going to be doing that. And we have some unique stories. The commanding general at Schofield, his grandfather happens to be on the wall. And we're going to get the opportunity to see him as a different person, not as the general at Schofield. He's going to be a human being escorting his grandfather to the wall.
Yeah, just a family connection.
Absolutely.
One of many.
A whole different version with the stars on his shoulder, and now he's going to be human.
Yeah, it's heavy stuff. The connections and the experiences. We've had so many people on the show as we talk about this 50th anniversary, because it's a big deal, whether it's Operation Baby Lift or the fall of Saigon and starting new lives in a new country.
Yes.
It's pretty powerful stuff.
It is, and we really look forward to just being able to educate a little bit more the younger generation that may have a grandfather or an uncle or somebody on that wall. And the website was a little bit late coming out, and we know that the group tours from the schools have become very difficult, mainly due to transportation issues, because our hope is that we'll still get some groups that come from the schools. The VVMF, which is the foundation that built the one in Washington, D.C. and continues to manage it, and then they built this one as well, they've created an entire curriculum on their website that the teachers can use if they want to share it. Because I realize these kids, even our daughter graduated in 2012, and there's maybe a half a page in the history book, and it was a much bigger event. And then my grandson just told me the other day, I haven't really studied that war yet.
But they need to know about it.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And our progression, when we moved the wall from the trailer, we were requested, we needed to avoid all the residential areas where all the schools really are, but there's a few on the main road. And so we're reaching out to those schools because we want them to be able to come out. We'll provide them with flags to wave as it goes by and maybe give them a reason to teach a little bit more about it along the way. So that will happen more when we get into Pearl City. We'll basically be going from Pier 1 all the way down Cam Highway, cutting over to Farrington to get on into Waipahu, and we'll be passing the high school and the middle school there. And then we'll get into Kapolei and be able to pass just about all the schools in Kapolei on the way to the university.
Yeah, and then it'll be set up for a short window, but it's an opportunity for people to come together and help heal.
And it's open all night. Oh. That's the main thing. It was surprising because we worked on it in Hilo and Maui, and there was such a surprising number of veterans that would come out at night on their own without the crowds. Didn't want any company, just wanted to go and reflect. It's a really great opportunity for everybody to participate because you will get very engaged.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It brings back, you can actually really reflect on what you did to be a part of this. Again, I've almost like been in the shadows on this thing for quite a while. Like I said, at least 50 years anyway since I left there. But it's an amazing thing. We have gone to the real wall in D.C., and it didn't have the same effect to me, the one that I saw there. I just continued my life as I was going. But after going to Hilo and seeing it in Hilo, it took a turn. I don't know, it was like somebody maybe flipped a switch, and I became more vocal about what happened, for I had all this held in for 50 years, good grief. is starting to come to term because I am a Agent Orange patient. And I never really thought of that being something that was happening because of my tour in Vietnam. But it was, you started having things that your family didn't have anything like that ever happen. And then when you finally did get checked up, you said, how is this 50 years later, I'm still feeling the effects of what happened when I was a youngster? I want to say a youngster. Cause
You were a youngster.
Yeah. Because to say now, the youngest person that would have been in Vietnam today would be 67 years old. And I'm past the 67. I definitely fit into that box that they have. And if you go to the clinics here, the two clinics here, you see all of these vets in there, right. And we're all going through the same thing. Whether it was Vietnam, Korea, World War II, whatever, we were all affected in some way. And we all have a clock inside of us as veterans. And we know when it's time to, I'm not going to say let it go. That's not the word
to use.
Come
to grips with it.
Yeah.
But to come to terms with what happened and stuff. And there's, everybody has their own time. So you can't say you got to be ready or you're supposed to be here or there. You just know when it's time to open up and say, hey, I can talk about this now without having too much. I mean, I'm emotional about it, sure, but I'm sure there's one other person out there that needs this as well.
Yeah, it's a wall that unites us and heals us all.
Yeah.
Thank you both for being here today.
And thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
That was Ed Freeman and Susan Bauer. The official opening ceremony for the Wall That Heals will be January 14th. Look for links on our website for more information, including how to volunteer to support the effort behind the Wall That Heals. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Have you ever noticed those flocks of finches with bright red-eye masks hanging out in the grassy fields? Well, this week, University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces you to the tiny waxbill. Common, but very eye-catching. Here's your Manu Minute.
The story of common waxbills is similar to that of many of our birds in the lowlands of Hawaii. Native to Africa, they were brought to Oahu as cage birds, where a few escaped and formed wild populations by the early 1970s. At only about 4 inches tall and weighing 8 or 9 grams, common waxbills are among the tiniest birds in the state. Both the males and females have a bright red eye mask and bright red-orange bills. The rest of their plumage is mainly grayish-brown, with fine black bars that you can only see if you get up close. Like many of the finches imported to Hawaii, they mainly feed on grass seeds. If you're driving along the road and see a flock of tiny birds clinging to the tall stalks of grasses, there's a good chance that some of them are common waxbills, especially if you hear their song and it sounds like this. Waxbills were first spotted on Maui in the late 1990s. On the Kona side of the Big Island in the early 2000s, and on the Hilo side just in the last 4 or 5 years. Now they're very common on both those islands, especially where there's tall grass, such as parks, open fields, and roadsides. They're a great example of how non-native bird species can quickly expand into unoccupied niches, especially in the lowlands, where we've lost most of our native bird species to introduced diseases. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Biology Department at UH Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, offering nature tours on Hawaii Island with adventures including swimming in private waterfalls, Mauna Kea stargazing, and exploring active volcanoes. More at hawaii-forest.com.
Tomorrow marks the start of the new year. Do you have a resolution? And what is it about a new year that makes us want to change in our lives? Ami Kunimura is the founder of the Self-Care Institute. She holds a doctorate degree in mind-body medicine and is offering an online workshop series to ring in the new year with closure and clarity. Kunimura spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender, and she starts with what's been on her clients' minds this year.
So one of the areas that I've been really addressing with my clients or the organizations I work with is looking at the intersection of stress management and social justice. And social justice, you know, this can also be very multidimensional. You know, we can look at when we see something in the political climate, in the social climate, or even in current events that triggers ourselves because it's going against our own values, or we're seeing something out in the world that hurts us, or we ourselves feel hurt or traumatized or triggered, or we're in pain somehow because of something happening in the world. What do we do with that? So social justice then intersects with stress management, because that becomes the stressor of whatever's happening at that certain time. The current event that's happening becomes a stressor. And what do we do about it? So when we're looking at stress management here, really we're looking at two parts. There's two parts of stress management. The first part is addressing the stressor. The second part of stress management is addressing the stress response. So, you know, we take the climate of 2025, and we look at all the different stressors that came our way, all these different things in the news. It can be, you know, natural events too, could be, you know, looking at climate, but it can be looking at, you know, political events or things that cause us worry or anxiety or pain or again, trauma or stress, and seeing how we get triggered. In this situation, sometimes it's hard to actually address the stressor. When something's a stressor that is so big that it's connected to a more systemic issue that maybe we can't resolve right away, that's when we can turn to the second part of stress management and manage the stress that's happening in our bodies. So managing the stress response. And this is going to be very important for us, because when we manage the stress in our body, we can then be stronger to manage or address the stressors that are out there. And some of the stressors that we're dealing with in the world today are not going to be resolved right away. Again, they can be very systemic or social. They're going to take time. And what we don't want to do is burn out while we're trying to address these really important changes that need to be made. And so when we look at the stress response in our bodies, it doesn't have to be that complicated in how we address our own stress response. It can look like, for example, right now, just taking a deep breath in through your nose and then slowly exhaling through your mouth. Taking a few breaths just to pause can be a very empowering gesture for us. It means that we're taking control over our own bodies. We're making choices in the moment. And then just a few breaths can help calm our nervous systems, lower your heart rate, lower your blood pressure. And then from that place, we can make better decisions or communicate more clearly. Other ways to address the stress response can be through movement or creativity or connecting with people who are supportive for you, or just simply moving your body or your breath in some way.
And as we look forward to 2026, it's obviously resolution season. People are asking each other what their resolutions might be. What do you think it is about the new year that makes people want to think about changes and put some of those resolutions into words?
Yeah, well, a new year and a new beginning is an opportunity for two things here. First, it's an opportunity to reevaluate and ask yourself some questions. So to reevaluate and reflect. Reflect on, what do I need? What do I want? What changes might I want here? And to, you know, I love that word resolution, and people can approach this in many different ways. It can be setting resolutions or goals. Some people like to think of a word for the year. And a new start can offer this mindset of, I have another chance. I have another opportunity to do this in a different way, whatever that might mean for you. And that can be refreshing. That can be hopeful. And then there is this energy at the beginning of a year where we feel like we get a new start somehow. And that's important for us to offer ourselves once in a while, whether it's a new year, whether it's your birthday, whether you're starting a new job, but to offer yourself the hope that comes with a new start can be very good for our self-confidence, to activate some courage, and to activate our own sense of self, of asking ourselves, what do I want? And I encourage people to think of resolutions that do honor yourself, that honors your own version of success, not anyone else's, but your very own. Along with that, though, comes also an opportunity for anxiety or stress, because when we are looking at change, any kind of change, even good changes, can bring stress. Change can be stressful, but that's okay. And another point here in stress management is that there's helpful stress and there's harmful stress. But a new year is a great opportunity to harness the helpful kind of stress that we want to have in our lives. And so, you know, when we make our resolutions, we're not aiming for having a totally stress-free year or having no problems or like everything's going to be perfect. You know, it's unrealistic. And also, research does show that we do want a certain amount of stress in our lives. Like, we're not aiming to eliminate stress. Research shows, especially at work, what we want to aim for is a healthy amount of stress where we have enough stimulation and growth that's happening in our lives, but without overwhelming ourselves. So the new year can offer us an opportunity to bring in some helpful stress that we choose. And that can look like going out of your comfort zone or stretching yourself in a certain way or setting a goal that pushes yourself, whether it's saying you want to exercise a little more, or maybe you want to travel to somewhere new, or you want to make a change in your life. Changes or new things can bring on stress, but that's the kind of stress we want to experience. It's the kind of stress that makes us feel alive. It makes us feel that we're growing, that we're here on planet Earth as a living, breathing human being, and we can feel ourselves in our bodies. You know, what we don't want to do is go into stagnation or boredom. And again, the beginning of the year can be that opportunity to reflect on, okay, what's that going to look like for me? What's it going to look like for me to go outside of my comfort zone, but still keep myself in a compassionate space? And what do I want this year?
Along those lines, do you think there are certain types of resolutions that you would maybe discourage a person from setting? Or are there certain ways that people talk about resolutions that you might invite them to reframe their thinking on?
Yeah. So I encourage resolutions that are compassionate. I do encourage people to avoid resolutions that have language around being very hard on yourself. And what you don't want to do is set yourself up for failure and then feeling really bad about not meeting a goal if it's not panning out the way you planned. So examples of language that can be hard on yourself, saying like, well, I have to do this or else, or putting consequences on yourself that are either unfair or unjust or not compassionate. But being very careful of being too hard on yourself when you're setting resolutions, and instead bringing in a more compassionate language. And I do encourage people to bring in some spaciousness to your resolutions. You know, you might make a resolution where you get to mid-January and you're like, oh, like this isn't exactly working out in some way, but maybe you can shift the language just a little bit so it can work out a little bit better for you. But again, we don't want to set ourselves up for failure, but it's a tricky balance of also we do want to push ourselves and we do want to set goals that are a little outside of our comfort zone, but we want to do so using kind and compassionate language with ourselves.
Do you have a resolution for 2026?
Actually, that word compassion is one that I'm working with right now. And my resolution, so the word compassion, we can look at as, you know, it being a warm sense of acceptance for yourself. And compassion can be this very loving and kind word, but really the root of compassion comes from the Latin root compati, which means to suffer with. And bringing the word suffering along with compassion can be a little alarming here, but really when we pair those two, we can look at compassion can mean being with yourself when you are suffering, when you are having a hard time. And that can be a huge act of self-care, to really be with yourself when you're having a hard time rather than abandoning your feelings or abandoning your needs or just distracting yourself. And so I'm still formulating the language around my resolution, but it is taking on this general theme of being with myself and my feelings rather than distracting myself. So, you know, in a moment when, you know, maybe I'm feeling anxious, trying not to go to my phone and scrolling on social media, instead putting that down, taking a few breaths with myself, but being with myself, being self-compassionate rather than turning to self-abandonment.
Is there anything else that you want to add or you'd want our listeners to know?
When it comes to self-care, especially in the new year, to make sure that you know that this is a lifelong endeavor. Self-care is not like this endpoint to get to, or we're not aiming for perfect self-care in this new year. We are going to aim for improvement and growth, but let's take off the pressure of trying to be perfect with our self-care or having perfectly balanced lives. That's not what we're aiming for here. We're aiming for growth, for improvement, and knowing that our self-care will adjust with the times, will adjust with ourselves as our lives unfold, but we're never aiming for perfect balance or perfect self-care. Our self-care will be this lifelong learning experience, and allow it to be a learning experience while also at the same time really believing in yourself. Believe in your ability to care for yourself and believe in your ability to manage stress also. Remember that our bodies are designed to handle stress, to respond to stress. Our bodies know what chemicals or hormones to release when we're stressed. Our bodies know to increase our heart rate or to have these physiological changes that we don't necessarily have to control. And that can be a beautiful thing. So to believe in your body's ability to respond to stress, believe in yourself and your ability to respond to the stressors that are coming. Some we know that we can anticipate, some we don't know yet. And that's okay. But knowing that our self-care never has to be perfect, but we can honor this as a lifelong learning endeavor. And at the same time, we can believe in ourselves as we do that.
Ami Kunimura, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you. You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
And that was therapist Ami Kunimura talking with HBR's Maddie Bender. Kunimura is to give a workshop about stress management and burnout prevention at the Kuikahi Meditation Center in Hilo on Thursday, January 8th. Look for links on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Pacific Health, committed to helping women get healthy at their women's 10K and 5K fun run next January. Details and registration at hphwomens10k.org.
On our year-end special, Climate One looks back on 2025 to review major events, climate policies and challenges, and inspiring leaders.
Joy has a purpose, because the people in power, the people who want you to believe that you can't make a difference in this world, want you to feel apathetic.
This year in climate, from Climate One.
Beginning tomorrow morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and take-out daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
You know, with the end of 2025, you may have been wondering if tonight would have been the last performance of the return of the Kapaimahu Hula Show. The story of the Healing Stones there in Waikiki was mounted by Kumuhula Patrick Makuakane and producers Joe Wilson and Dean Hamer. Wilson and Hamer spent $200,000 from their grant with the Mellon Foundation as part of an ongoing queer histories project in Hawaii. The Hawaii Tourism Authority also provided $50,000, and it's unclear if this will be the end of the run or just end of the first season. The show is dark tonight and will make its final run through January 28th. We caught up with some of the performers on Christmas Eve. It was supposed to be dark for the holiday, but the dancers decided to mount a show for the visiting families on the holiday because the previous show was rained out. We hear from a number of the performers, but we start out with sound and light engineer Peter Sturgis talking about what made this production so special.
I've been doing the hula shows here on the mound for close to 3 years, but this show is so special because the quality of the cast and the production is so high. The shows I do regularly, they're the local halaus doing regular hula shows, and they bring the keiki on the weekends, and it's a lovely show. But this, in terms of for a pure artistic experience, for lack of a better word, is the quality is so high. It's just such a pleasure to do the show, and I'm really proud to be a part of it.
And Mark Maui Kaneohe'alani Lovell is a teacher at Waikiki Elementary who believes that the story of the sense of place is important.
As a teacher, it's important for me to find examples, not just of authentic culture, which I teach, but also of instances within the culture that still bear relevance to current events, to national politics, to things that my students may see. On that level, I'm really gratified to be and grateful to be a part of this cast. But on a personal level, to partake in something that elevates and memorializes these four extraordinary individuals is a rare opportunity out of all of these Native Hawaiian practitioners and dancers and hula people. Like, I was fortunate enough to occupy this. I don't come from that community. I don't spend time in that community as often as I probably should, but carrying one of their stories and trying to give it integrity has been one of the biggest joys of my life up until this point.
I don't know, have your students come down to watch you dance?
Some of them have already seen it. My faculty have. My principal is one of these beautiful, forward-thinking people who is trying to find a way to allow me the space necessary to transmit the story. And I have to scale this to fifth graders all the way down to kindergartners, and you cannot tell the same story in the same way and have the same impact. So it's a really lovely challenge, but it's a challenge nonetheless. But it's one that, having done this now for an entire year, I could not imagine my life without this production or having not had this opportunity.
I know folks that have come to see the show are really proud of it, that, you know, you've got this high-quality hula on the beach in Waikiki for free. It's a gift.
I think Kumu Patrick Makuakane is an outlier, and I mean that in the most positive sense in the word, because his ethic, his choreography, his approach does not resemble any of his contemporaries or his teachers, and that makes anything that he does unique. He's the only Native Hawaiian winner of the MacArthur Genius Grant, and that speaks to his ability to take a story and then to convert it into something that will create an impact among people, especially one that resonates emotionally. I feel like that's been a huge challenge for the Native Hawaiian community in general, is to find these emotional moments where people who do not necessarily come from our culture or share anything in common with it will still find common ground simply because they feel something that resonates so personally and so deeply that they could not imagine not caring about what we happen to care for endemically. And he has that gift. There's not a lot of people who can do that gift. We can translate our stories into books. We have amazing storytellers. We have incredible theatric productions. This is one of those few events that actually coordinates all three into a package that cultural people, non-cultural people, indigenous people, non-indigenous people, Hawaii people, non-Hawaii people can find common ground on. the fact that it centers the story of the Mahu so unapologetically makes it all the more relevant and all the more important.
And Kaimana Domingo is a longtime flight attendant, 17 years at Hawaiian, and before that, 9 years at Aloha Airlines. He is struck by how night after night the audience is moved by the story.
One thing that it is for free, and it's a fabulous and amazing show, but the one thing that gets me is the people that we touch, that we talk to after we get off stage, on how much we've impacted them. There's countless times that I've had people come up to us and say how much they've connected to us through either them, their kids are struggling with their gender identity, because this is a movement. This is a movement show, all the while explaining on what Kapai Mahu is, bringing out the Hawaiian culture and also a movement. The thing that gets me through this show is witnessing the people's testimonies after the show and how much we've impacted their lives.
And Kumuhula Keola Kamahele manages the show for Patrick Makuakani, who is based in San Francisco. Kamahele is just grateful to be part of such a powerful show.
I feel blessed. Luckily, how Patrick orchestrated the show, it doesn't matter what age you are. So it's the idea that hula stays with you your entire life. Yeah, it's not just a young thing anymore. It is. But for the most part, you can dance until you drop. I'm also his manager here when he's away, and lead dancer. I get the rehearsals together and make sure the dancers are ready. So that's been an education for me in becoming a new kumu at my age. So all of this is a part in assisting Patrick to get his message out. And so I just feel very fortunate to be a part of that.
Well, you know, I think because this hula is about a story and, you know, of this place, and that it just resonates, particularly, I think, during these very difficult times when the community is maybe scared about how they're being treated.
Well, and for me, you know, because I lived on the mainland for 30 years, I just returned home a few years ago, and I lived there and worked with continental people as well, Americans as well. And, you know, it can very be easily looked at that we're the soft ones, you know, we're always going to comfort and, well, you know what? That's where the soul is at. That's where the real mana is at. It's not in this outwardly expressive, overtly expression of power and mana. It's invert. It's the mother. It's the nurturing. And so that's why it's, you know, olelo makuahine. Our stories come from how our mothers told them to us, and we pass them on. It's very matriarchal. And that, I think, is important for people to know. That's how in touch Polynesians as a whole, or what we ever call this huge triangle now, that's how we learned. It was through the process of being next to mama, being next to papa. What was our destiny? Okay, we're fishermen, we're fishermen. We were the best fishermen, but we were fishermen. So all of this to come back now, it's, to me, it's, I don't know what's gonna happen. I have no predictions, except to say, we're just trying to do our little bit, our little part. And we as storytellers do that best when we do it through hula.
We've been hearing from the cast and crew from the return of the Kapai Mahu, the free hula show at the Kuhio Beach Hula Mound in Waikiki. Look for links on our website to find out more about the final shows that run through January. The final performance is on the 28th at 6:30 p.m. Patrick Makuakani plans to be there on that final evening. Well, we have to go now, but up tomorrow we will air special programming as we celebrate the new year. Got hopes for 2026? Tell us your resolutions. Call our talkback line 808-792-8217 or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also tag HPR in a post on Facebook or Instagram. Find the conversation's past segments on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Friday for more of The Conversation.